From 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you, and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available on iTunes.
I'm Sharon Gamble. Welcome to The Art of the Matter. This week we'll hear about the Great American Songbook Academy, meet a band that lists grunge and Ravel among its influences, and check out a program that uses music to help Alzheimer's patients and their caregivers. And don't forget, we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do?
You won't want to miss a word right after the latest news from NPR. Welcome back to The Art of the Matter from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. Today, a play that explores a controversial aspect of female identity at the Phoenix Theater. But first, what if that tune that's on repeat on your music player today could help you if you suffer memory problems down the road? That's the premise of a popular program offered for free to people dealing with Alzheimer's disease and other neurodegenerative diseases. It's offered to their caregivers as well. I invited program manager Chris Brush, who's also a music educator, and advisor Carol Applegate, who practices senior law and was instrumental in starting the program, to tell me how it works. Carol, I'm going to start this with you. Where did this idea come from for the Perfect Harmony program?
Well, you know, I am an elder law attorney, and so I deal with a lot of families and family members of those who are suffering from Alzheimer's and memory losses. And I have just seen the importance of music in caring for these kind of clients. And my mother is also in an assisted living facility. And she played the piano and the organ all of her entire life. And so her organ has sort of followed her, you know, as she has grown older. And it is now in the facility where she is residing as a resident, and she plays the organ every morning every Sunday morning for church. And that has really brought her some purpose to her life, because as they go through this process and find themselves in a facility, they sort of lose hope and purpose. And just by giving her that, her organ and her music to play, that has given her something to look forward to every single week, and has given her a lot more purpose to her life. So I just feel like it's so important for these clients to have some purpose at the end of life.
It's in particular, in the case of your mother, it sounds as though it harkens back to a very different phase of her life when she learned music.
Absolutely. You know, she never had a piano lesson, never took lessons. She just played by ear. And even though her memory is failing somewhat, she can sit down at the organ or the piano and play just for memory. And so we see that a lot. It goes back, and she plays those songs that she learned as a child and as she was growing up. And she also gets much joy in being able to share that with the grandchildren. And likes when she comes to my house, she automatically goes into the piano and plays.
Wow. Chris, you're kind of coming at this whole program from a different perspective, that of a musician, hands-on musician, voice-on musician, I guess I should say, and music educator. What was your first exposure to the idea of using music to help people who were beginning to struggle with memory?
Well, the idea for Perfect Harmony started for us a couple of years ago, because we have staff members both at the Great American Songbook Foundation and at the Center of the Performing Arts who have aging parents who are in assisted living facilities, some of whom are dealing with Alzheimer's, dementia, or other neurodegenerative disorders. And we focus a lot and very publicly on promoting the music of the songbook to younger audiences through our Songbook Academy program. We realized that in our community we had a ready-made constituency of people who we didn't need to introduce to the music, mm-hmm. who were very familiar with the music of the Great American Songbook, and in fact who are people who we could engage with and to provide a new kind of music experience using music that they were already aware of and familiar with.
Does this surprise you personally as someone who's a musician and an educator?
No, I think that it's I think it's not surprising at all to find that people are drawn to music of their youth. There have been recent studies that have shown the connection between music that we experience as teenagers and as young adults has a very impactful role throughout the duration of our lives, and this is a continuation of that. We're, in some cases, reintroducing people to the music that they knew and loved and have in some cases, forgotten.
And I love that something that maybe to those of us in this conversation is intuitive, but the science is catching up with this as well. Just hardly a month passes without another article about the cognitive benefits of learning music, no matter what stage of life. Even if you don't intend to become a musician, you don't intend to become a singer. This is a monthly program. It's free. How do people hear about it?
It has been mostly through word of mouth. It started out as a monthly program, and over the course of the past year, it has increased fairly steadily as we have added additional communities to the program each week. So now we're doing a session most Wednesdays at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. We're also doing additional sessions throughout the week with specific communities who bring a particular group. We're somewhat limited in size, and we want to make sure that the experience is one that is personal for everyone, so we've now expanded to doing more offerings each week. But it did start out as that once monthly experience.
And the person that the program is aimed for is generally accompanied by one or more caregivers, right?
Yes, that's correct. Most people bring a caregiver. Sometimes it's a child or someone that stays with them during the day. We also have communities from retirement homes in Carmel and the surrounding area that come with designated caregivers who assist the participants.
Now, I don't want you to break any confidentiality rules, but I want each of you to tell me a story of something you've witnessed at one of your programs.
I have not witnessed anything at their particular program, but I recently visited a memory care unit where there was a gentleman who was singing and playing a guitar and playing the keyboard and so forth with a group who were in a memory care unit. And you could see just their faces and their eyes and just sort of light up when they heard a song that they remembered, and they would clap, and maybe they could remember some of the words, maybe they couldn't. But it just they just come alive when they hear that kind of music, especially music that they've been raised with and can remember. And they associate that with a memory of some kind. Mm-hmm. And so you really, it was so fascinating to see them, you know, come alive when they heard that music.
Yeah.
I would say for me, it's the experience of seeing people reconnect with a musical story that obviously meant something to them at a previous point in their life. That can be a variety of different things. And we have a monthly theme for Perfect Harmony, and several months ago the theme was just novelty songs. And so the song Tequila was one of the songs for that month. Very easy, only one word. And there was one particular person who was there in attendance for one of the sessions who had been very quiet, who had been singing along but hadn't really engaged too much. And all of a sudden she jumped up and just started dancing around.
Wow.
And she grabbed one of our volunteers and started dancing around for the song. And it was just one of those examples where we see someone reconnect to something that excited them or brought them happiness or brought them joy. And that's really our emphasis for the program. One of the things that has meant the most to us is just creating this connection. We had the daughter of one of the participants tell us several months ago that as she was leaving after one of the Perfect Harmony sessions, you know, my mother is very rarely happy and in a good mood, but when we come here, she always leaves happy. And that's a blessing for both of us. And so that, in a real personal way, I think, you know, shows the experience that people are having when they come to the Songbook Foundation for Perfect Harmony.
And I've seen them also, like you said, they may be in a wheelchair, they may be not able to get up and walk, but just the listening to that music, they can't stay still. You know, they're moving, or they're trying to get out of their wheelchair to dance and to have some movement. So it's not only cognitive stimulation, but their bodies move a little more.
Chris Brush and Carol Applegate with the Center for the Performing Arts Perfect Harmony Program. The program, developed in collaboration with the Greater Indiana Chapter of the Alzheimer's Association, provides regularly scheduled group programs for individuals with early-stage Alzheimer's and for their caregivers. For more information, contact the Songbook Foundation at 317-844-2251. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Coming up in just a bit, Michael Feinstein is nurturing the next generation of singers. But right now, Jolene Ketzenberger brings us a new journey for food and beverage lovers.
So we are here today talking with entrepreneur Nick Carter of MarketWagon.com and various other enterprises. So thank you so much for being here.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks, Jolene.
Well, now tell me what it is and what it started out. Did it start out different, and how did it evolve?
Yeah, it's MarketWagon.com, and it is an online farmer's market in the sorts that delivers. So we give the producers unlimited access to the market. They list their products. They set their own prices. They describe it. They can market their products. They can drive traffic to it. They can interact with the consumers. So customers go to our site and they shop and they find several different farmers producing eggs. They have a conversation with them. They can chat with them about what feed they use or how they rotate them across the pastures. And they choose the farm that they want to buy eggs from. They place an order. The eggs come straight from the farm to us. We aggregate all these orders from a 12-county area in central Indiana, and then we deliver to homes and businesses all around.
Right to their door.
Right to their door, okay. For a fee, or there's free pickup locations. There's about 33 pickup locations in central Indiana that it's free if you're willing to go to those hubs.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So now how do you start building something like that? So when you started it, when it was farmersmarket.com, how did you start saying, okay, well, now we've got an online farmer's market. but how do you start that?
Yeah, there's the tech, right? We had to have a platform. And so I and a couple of other developers that I managed, we built that and we had the platform. But then it's and if you build it, they will come. You know, we had to get farmers to sign on to a very new idea. And so there was a lot of, we call it foraging. Now, it's actually a core part of our business. We're up to 92 vendors already in our market, but we're still constantly looking for more. And so, and it was January of 2016 we launched. We only had 12 vendors and 45 products, and we went live.
45 products, like what?
Yeah, well, it was January of 2016, but we had a hydroponics farm, so we had a little bit of produce. We had eggs, honey, and one meat vendor. So we had some grass-fed beef and poultry and things like that.
So how did that go? How did it start?
We had our first launch in Moody's Butcher Shop in Geist. So they hosted us as a free pickup location.
Pickup mm-hmm. site, okay.
I remember the very first week we had 15 orders and we were high fives all around the office. You know, when one came in, we were ecstatic. We had no idea what the response would be. And it was overwhelming. I mean, people really loved the idea. They reacted well to it. And so did the farmers. Even though 15 orders was not enough to make them excited at all, they could see where we were headed. And they've stuck with it and grown with us. And today, tomorrow morning, we'll ship out about 150 orders.
So. Now, how does that work? What's the timing like, you know, when people order, and how does that happen?
Orders are due every week, Tuesday night at midnight. And so then what our software does is around 1 o'clock in the morning on Wednesday morning, it emails every farmer exactly what they sold and who they sold it to. So
okay.
If you think about being at a farmer's market, you got to pack up your entire inventory and drive there. Keep it cold.
Put it back out.
And put it back out.
Right.
Sit there for 4 hours and go home. So with us, when they arrive to our facility then on Thursday morning, that stuff is all sold. They know they sold it all. It's already bought and paid for. They're just bringing it for the customers that we can then take it out that Thursday and deliver. So Tuesday is when the order cutoff is, and then Thursday afternoon we deliver to the consumers.
So they get their order, and then they harvest or gather up whatever it is they need to do.
Yeah. This is the phenomenal part. I mean, if you're talking about produce, these orders go out. The pick tickets is what we call it, which is a warehouse term for picking off of the shelf. But to the produce vendors, it literally means on Wednesday that's what they're picking out of the field.
Oh, so that's a real pick
it's
ticket.
It's fresh produce. This stuff is showing up as fresh as you can possibly imagine. Yeah.
So it has been a success, apparently.
Yeah. How
much have you grown?
Well, I mentioned our very first week we had 15 customers.
Right.
And today we're doing about 150 orders a week. We've got well over 1,000 customers that are regular. We've got we just expanded into Evansville. So we've taken the model and replicated it down in Evansville, Indiana, and we're getting ready to do so in other areas of the state. And by next year, we'll be expanding outside of Indiana.
So that's the goal then,
yeah.
Right?
I think every town should have an online farmers market that can deliver.
You can hear Jolene Ketzenberger's Eat, Drink, Indie Saturday mornings at 11 on WFYI HD2, The Point. You're tuned to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Indianapolis-based indie rock group Elliot Bigger is our featured small studio session band for July. WFYI's Melissa Davis has the story.
If you ask the musicians of Elliot Bigger to classify their sound, you'll get a mix of progressive and classic rock, along with a bit of pop and even a hint of classical drumming. Guitarist-vocalist Kara Tucker, guitarist Joel Tucker, bassist Jameson Rhodes, and drummer Aaron Jeter formed Elliot Bigger around an Indianapolis home fireplace in 2012.
Joel and I both went to IU, so that is how, in Bloomington, so that's how I knew Joel, but Joel and Kara are actually brother and sister-in-law. So they started jamming together, and then I joined, and then we all had mutual friends with Jameson.
And what did it feel like to lose? And what did you give up? Not too apt to choose what to do with the bad, bad.
Kara and Joel Tucker have played in several bands over the past few years, but this is the first rock band experience for drummer Aaron Jeter and bassist Jameson Rhodes.
This is my first band, and I've always wanted to be in a band, and here it is. I've just waited for the right people.
Yeah.
And it's an amazing group.
Kara and Joel spent lots of time trying to think up the perfect band name, but a quick decision was made after combining literary favorites.
Well, she asked me, Joel, what's your favorite book, and what's your favorite literary character? And I said, God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater, by Kurt Vonnegut, and Elliot Rosewater is his name. So that's where the Elliot comes from, and the spelling of Elliot, because it's not normally spelled like that.
And then my favorite book is Native Son by Richard Wright, and that's the main character is Bigger Thomas, and that book, so that's where the Bigger comes from. And that's actually, this is Native Son, the band in Indianapolis. It's also a reference to that same book, which is kind of cool, so...
Their debut album is called Murals, which also showcases Kara's painting.
And the title comes from, it's kind of a concept album, and if you get the album and you open it up, you see all the art. A lot of the songs I was writing in conjunction to them, I was also painting, creating art to them. So the art on the front of it is also the piece, the painting that you see if you check out our music video, which is called, it's called Murals. The painting that's happening in the background is me actually painting in time, so yeah.
The musicians plan to grow their fan base, play more out-of-town shows, and maybe even take their music worldwide.
Now, my big dream is to travel. I think if you can travel playing music, that's like, I want to go to India. That's my big bucket list. I don't know if there's a spot for us there, but
we'll find it.
We'll find it if there is.
Yeah, I think just finding a good following of people who really enjoy our music, make a couple more records.
Yeah.
Travel a bit.
Bye.
Yeah, keep making the records, keep writing.
Yeah.
That's my whole purpose. Mm-hmm.
You can find Elliot Bigger's entire small studio session at wfyi.org/small studio. Mm-hmm.
Learn lots more about Elliott Bigger and watch their small studio session at wfyi.org/small-studio. Small Studio is made possible by a grant from the Herbert Simon Family Foundation and by support from Neato Art Shop and Sun King Brewery. 40 of the nation's top high school vocalists are in town this week, competing to be named the Songbook Youth Ambassador. It's all part of the yearly Great American Songbook Academy, as WFYI's Jill Dittmeyer learned.
Sharon, this takes place right here in Indianapolis up at the Center for the Performing Arts, and it's such a great opportunity for these young performers and, of course, for that monumental music that is all part of the Great American Songbook tradition. Michael Feinstein has been offering this week-long intensive for the past 8 years, and each year it just gets bigger and better. So recently I sat down with finalist Kayla Dobbinsbach, who's actually from Indiana. She's from Lebanon, along with Lucas DeBard, who also is from Lebanon, but now he is a college student at IU. And in 2015, he was the Songbook Ambassador. And joining us as well was Chris Lewis. He is the executive director of the Great American Songbook Foundation. And he said that process of selecting those 40 finalists is intense.
They send in YouTube videos. Then we have a panel of screeners that are also from across the country. They're music educators and professional performers who screen every application and audition and provide written feedback to every single person who applies. So everybody who applies to the Academy gets 3 to 5 written evaluations from our screeners. And we go through that process. They narrow it down to the top, I don't know how many, and then it's a screening process that goes through 2 or 3 iterations, and then we end up with the top 40 singers in the country who will join us in just a few weeks.
Wow. And Kayla, to hear him talk about that, about how everyone was selected and you were selected, does that take your nerve level up a little bit higher or give you a little bit more assurance?
Both. Both. But it makes me feel very assured that this is a great honor to have, and I'm very excited to be in the program.
Tell me why you wanted to be in the program and what it was like when you got that call or that email or the notification.
Well, I actually heard about it from Lucas because he was in it. We went to school together. He was in it first. And I kind of already knew the genre of music, the Great American Songbook. I already really loved it. And I heard about the Academy and all the things that they got to do from him and all of the amazing teachers and things that he got to learn from. And I was like, that's incredible, you know, to have that experience, to be able to learn from those people is like nothing that I've ever like been a part of before. So I knew from that moment that I really wanted to be in it. And I got the email. I was actually in school and I got it and I was in class and I like ran up to the teacher and I was like, I have to call my mom. Please let me call my mom. I was so excited.
And I'm sure she was excited as well.
Definitely. I think she cried a little bit.
Lucas, did you cry when you were notified several years ago that you were a finalist?
I didn't cry, but in the middle of a quiet classroom, I got up and cheered a little bit, and everyone kind of looked at me like I was crazy, but I didn't care because I was so excited.
And it really changed your whole career, didn't it?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I had done this competition for 3 years. First year, I made it to the what was then kind of the top 40. Second year, I didn't make it at all. I didn't make it past pre-screening and all of that. Third year, I won. So from then to now, my love for this kind of music has just grown and grown. And, you know, I have you guys to thank for that. So,
and that really is kind of the purpose. It is the continuation of the Great American Songbook for a whole new generation, isn't it?
It really is. I mean, this program was conceived for just that purpose, to expose young people to this important genre of music and its history. What we learned was there are many students out there, many young people who like this music but don't have an outlet. You know, this music isn't featured on primetime television, on American Idol and The Voice. And so Lucas is a perfect example of this program that, you know, he joined us, but he kept coming back. And we had the opportunity to continue working with him. He told me that third year, the year after he didn't make it past pre-screening, that his only goal was to get to the Palladium. He wanted to sing on the Palladium stage, which he did. And then he's gone on to perform at Carnegie Hall and the Kennedy Center and venues all across the country. I mean, it's amazing singing this music. I mean, he was our official ambassador for a year and continues to be.
And what an opportunity for all of these outstanding singers from all across the country at such a young age to be exposed to that, Lucas. And I'm sure that gave you the confidence to go on as with your career.
Yeah, and I, you know, before before winning or anything like that, I didn't think that I could have a performing career. I didn't think that I could do it. And I learned how. In the best hands, you know. I have mentors all over the country now. Not just Michael, all over the country. People from the songbook that have made a huge impact on my career and my style and my voice. So, it's changed my life, and I can't wait to keep seeing what I can do with it and with the music that they've taught me how to sing.
Kayla, what is it about the style of music that just enraptures you and makes you want to sing it?
I think most people's first experience with the music is during Christmas time. You know, the Bing Crosby, you know, kind of CDs. It's that warmth and it's that kind of glow from within that I really fell in love with. And then when I branched out to find more music, I was already in love with musical theater, so I was kind of picking up things and being like, oh, I didn't know this was a song from the Great American Songbook genre. And I was falling more in love with it. And it's like the richness of the voices, the different interpretations. I think that it's relative to today as well as back then.
And if you had to give each of the finalists, and especially Kayla, like one tip to keep in mind as they compete, what would it be, Lucas?
This is really cliche and really cheesy, but be yourself. Don't go on stage and be a character. When you sing a song like this in a setting that's not a theater show, you have to interpret the song through you. You have to find the life experience that you've gone through and put that through the song and use the lyric as best as you can to tell your own story. You know, it's not, the music is such an important part of this, but the lyric is the most important part. So telling the story and being yourself through that process is, I think, the number one thing I can tell anyone.
And Kayla, no matter what happens, how is this going to change you as you head into the next part of your education and your future?
I am extremely grateful to be in it no matter what, and to be able to learn from people like Michael Feinstein. That's something that I never thought I would be able to have. And it's such an incredible experience that I'll be able to learn from it, and I'll be able to have things that I can use throughout my career for the rest of my life.
And of course, she will indeed. In fact, none of these participants will ever forget this opportunity. And guess what? You at home, you listeners, you can see and hear the performers as well. They are going to be giving three performances, and two of them are actually free. The finals night is July the 22nd at the Palladium. Tickets for that performance are on sale now online at thesongbook.org.
Well, I think we have some vocal music and some other great things on today's calendar we call
What'll We Do?
What do you have?
Well, the Indie Film Fest is going on right now, and one of the featured films comes from the Earth Charter Kids. This is this wonderful Indiana group of students who are out there promoting the environment and standing up against climate change. In fact, they were able to get that beautiful climate recovery resolution passed by the Indianapolis City County Council, and it's been made into a documentary film. It's called Little Warriors, and July the 20th will be your last opportunity to see it at 8:15 p.m. at the Indianapolis Museum of Art.
Speaking of art and museums, the Heron School of Art's Design Gallery is showing Jacqueline Cedar's painting exhibition called Mirror, Mirror. That's on view through September 2nd. And make a special note of that, because lots of times people think, oh, college campus, everything shuts down in the summer. not entirely true. This is an exhibit in which figures engage each other physically and psychologically. Their gestures are echoed and amplified by the environment. Really fascinating stuff. And, you know, if it's a hot day, that's a nice thing. Go into a nice, cool art gallery and change your perspective. Once again, Jacqueline Cedar's paintings on view through September 2nd.
Thursday, July 27th, the 28th, and the 29th, it's the Indianapolis Shakespeare Company. They're bringing free Shakespeare outdoors once again down along beautiful White River State Park. You can get your seat. They have free seats, as a matter of fact, that you can unfold and sit upon. They'll have food trucks. They'll have adult beverages starting at 6 o'clock. And then the performance starts at 8 p.m. Admission is free. This is something for the entire family, a great way to get an up-close and personal and very understandable way to be introduced to Shakespeare. And this year they are performing As You Like It.
Fun. All right, free association time. I say cowbell jazz. You say...
Sign me up.
Well, Cowbell Jazz featuring Yvonne Alou is taking place on July 20th. It's part of Animals and All That Jazz at the Indianapolis Zoo, and it's part of a whole summer's worth of musical offerings. And you might also want to go hungry, because each concert features a different menu of specialty food options. And if you're old enough, you can also enjoy samples of craft beers from a rotating list of local breweries, including Metazoa Brewing, Sun King Brewing, and Two Deep Brewing, and a Cash Bar as well. So check that out online on the Indianapolis Zoo's website. But coming up on the 20th, Cowbell Jazz.
And running through the end of September down at the Indiana State Museum is that beautiful photography exhibit of Indiana limestone, showcasing some of the most important buildings in our country that are actually made from limestone, the bedrock from southern Indiana. 30 original photographs, award-winning photographer Jeffrey Wolin's work, over 30 years of his work and all different aspects of limestone in use. Really something for everyone to get a look at the Indiana State Museum through the end of September.
So here's a participatory experience. It's taking place at the JCC on Sunday, July 23rd. It's called A Refugee Simulation. Here's their description. You can walk a mile in a refugee's shoes. It's an hour-long simulation that allows you to assume the identity and the role of a refugee. You'll be given the opportunity to learn what experiences a refugee is faced with once forced to flee their country. You can encounter seven stations meant to mimic the process a refugee would encounter. And, of course, the idea is simple empathy and the hope that you might be interested in getting involved in causes. It's sponsored by the Coalition for Our Immigrant Neighbors in partnership with the Unity Project. That's all going on Sunday, July 23rd at the JCC. You can learn more at jccindy.org.
Still about a month out, but August 13th, it's the third annual Bloomington Boogies. It's their Blues and Boogie Woogie Piano Festival that takes place in downtown Bloomington. It's parts of it are free, parts of it are ticketed. Names that you know, names that you'll want to know, plus, once again, lots of food and beverages. More information and tickets available at bloomingtonboogies.com.
In the 1880s and 1890s, especially in the United States, crazy quilts were, well, crazy popular. If you didn't have a crazy quilt, somebody else in your family probably had one or was making one. And there's an exhibit on view at the Indianapolis Museum of Art right now tracing the history and the story of crazy quilts with some beautiful work. Sometimes it was a group project. You'd make a square and your neighbor would make a square and you'd bring it all together. And that's how it got to be crazy. That's all going on at the IMA. It's through January 2018. But again, a nice opportunity to go into the air conditioning and see something beautiful.
And if we haven't given you enough options of things to see, do, and be a part of, well, you can find more at theindiearts.org/guide. That's the Arts Council of Indianapolis's Indie Arts Guide. Or join us again next week and we'll go through that calendar that we call
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and central Indiana. Your host is Sharon Gamble.
If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202, or you can email us at aotm@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. Seth Rosin runs a contemporary theater in Philadelphia called Interact, and it's much like Indianapolis's Phoenix Theater, exploring current topics that are often unsettling. Seth is also a playwright whose new play is receiving a series of rolling premieres throughout the U.S. via the National New Play Network. His new piece, Human Rights, that's R-I-T-E-S, tackles some controversial aspects of female sexuality. So here's a warning. If you have children under the age of about 16, you might want to tune away for the next 8 or 9 minutes. So you're kind of famous now about setting a wonderfully intimate human relationship at the center of a bigger story about something pertaining to the human condition. Did you realize that that's what you're doing? Of course you did.
Sounds good. I'll take that.
He'll take that. How did this particular topic come to you?
Well, my father is a fairly eminent professor of psychology and a very good colleague of his at the University of Chicago named Rick Schwader sent him a paper of his that my father read and sort of turned his head around, and he said, "Hey, I think you ought to read this. There may be something in it for you from a dramatic perspective." And I read it, and it turned my head around, and I immediately thought there was a play here. This is a paper that really wasn't doing research of its own. It wasn't its own research. It was auditing research that was out there in the field about female initiation rites, mostly in Africa, pertaining to circumcision, which is commonly known in the West as female genital mutilation. And it's a paper that basically argued that despite the narrative that we've accepted in the West through a wide range of media outlets and activism, is maybe not as accurate as we would like to think. And in fact, the 200 million estimated women and girls who undergo this practice throughout sub-Saharan Africa and other parts of the world choose to do it. They're not forced to do it by anyone. It is not a patriarchal practice, and that we have a misunderstanding of its value to the people who actually choose to do it. And it really, this paper really turned my head around and made me think that we tend to come to easy assumptions and a fairly secure morality around such topics without necessarily knowing what's true about them and how people actually choose to engage in these practices. And that led me to a larger idea, which also came out of this paper, which is that it never occurs to us that maybe some of our practices, our rites and rituals here in the West, particularly in America, might be viewed by other cultures as offensive, as barbaric, as inappropriate. And so that's really where all of this led.
For example, male circumcision.
Well, that's one for sure that gets brought up in the play. The morality that we have around male circumcision versus female is completely incongruous. Male circumcision is considered sort of automatic. It's not even considered something that we should have any concern about, to the point where we don't even know, nobody in this country or in Europe really understands the original purpose of the foreskin, that it's not even considered a body part. Whereas female alterations to female genitals is considered barbaric almost under any circumstances, even though it is pretty much widely understood that in all the cultures that practice circumcision, and only a couple practice only male, which includes ours, but most practice both. In almost all these cases, the original reasons for doing the practice on both men and women was the same, which is to curtail sexual arousal and control it a little bit more. So why do we have such a ridiculously imbalanced view of one versus the other?
What a fascinating litmus test for gender politics, sexual politics. So how did you come up with, and I'm going to ask you to, without giving too much away, but briefly describe the, mm-hmm. the characters and the bigger plot.
Sure. So the idea that came to me was an African-American dean, a woman who is very successful, very impressive, very much holds the standard liberal, progressive views on things, calls a professor into her office who presented this very paper to his students, and is asking him basically to consider retracting the paper and not having it be published because she feels it may draw attention, unwanted attention to the university and create controversy where maybe there shouldn't be, but also because they have a history, these two academic heavyweights. They had an affair some 12, 13 years ago, and so there's other water under the bridge there that hasn't been fully wrestled with. And so the play has both a personal and a political dimension to it. And then the dean, who feels that she's coming into this interaction with a great deal of power and superiority, both from a personal and professional standpoint, finds that the professor is pretty much going to dig his heels in and stick to what he believes and what he's researched. So she brings in a surprise visitor, and the intensity of the conversation and the stakes of the conversation go way up. And the idea is that we are, at first, we probably will choose sides, and I'm guessing most people will choose a particular side, and then when the third character comes on, it throws all of that out the window, and you really have to wrestle with your own assumptions about our own cultural values.
Wow. You've lived with this script for a while. You had a reading at your home theater, your theater, Interact, in Philadelphia, mm-hmm. and you've had a couple of workshops, including here at the Phoenix Theater, a couple of readings. Mm-hmm. What have the audiences shown you in that process?
Well, there's only been one actual audience at any of the readings. There have been There have been two audiences and two additional private read-throughs, and the audiences at the two public readings were highly engaged, and immediately following the reading, led right into a very dynamic, excited discussion with people arguing in the best possible way about how we feel about these things, and it definitely provoked people of all types to rethink things and to ask questions. So actually, one of the ways that the play I think picked up steam at the Phoenix to produce was that we did a reading there that was private, and one of the people who was sort of in the background while we were reading through the play was he was doing some tech work and cleaning up the rehearsal room that we were in, and he was overhearing the play and ultimately sat down and listened to it. And at the end, he said, "My God, this is making me think about so much. We got to do this play." And that was exactly the kind of response I was hoping for. It forces you to think about things, I hope, in an ultimately positive and useful way. And so far, that's been the case with the response from everyone, including the actors who've worked on all the different readings.
Seth Rosin's new play, Human Rights, opens at the Phoenix Theater at the end of July. Learn more at phoenixtheater.org. Every week, a Cultural Manifesto's Kyle Long talks five songs with someone from our community. Here's this week's journey.
I'm Kyle Long from Cultural Manifesto, and I'm here with the Indianapolis-based beatmaker Nick Mandog Smith. Thank you for being here, Mandog.
Thank you.
And Mandog, you have a new project out along with the Indianapolis rapper Diop Adisa. It's titled Flow Flexin', and it's available now on Amazon, iTunes, Bandcamp, wherever you want to buy music online. And you have five songs to share with us today,
Got
right?
Five of them. So this first song is called Turn Me Up Some by Ab Soul featuring Kendrick Lamar. I went to a MERS show back several years back, and Ab Soul was actually opening up for him, so I had never heard of him and kind of went online to check out who he was, and this was the first track, and I immediately fell in love, and it was actually my introduction to both Ab Soul and Kendrick, and been a big TDE fan since then. Extraterrestrial being, eat me a meteor and walk across the moon bare feet, but don't nobody rhyme like this no more. Call me the 2010 Rakim. I got soul, it's more store, feel like a CBS. Your second pick. So my second pick is it's a song called Lay Me Down by Crosby and Nash. It's just a song that I really like to listen to a lot of times, maybe before I fall asleep, but just real chill, like the vibes.
Driving out through the windmills, and some of them were still. Sometimes it's hard to catch the wind and bend it to your will. Though it's hard to know just how the story ends, the road is long and it takes its time, on that you can depend.
And number three,
the song is High Noon by the Mud Kids. Mud Kids are big heroes of mine, Naptown legends. And yeah, just a great song.
Cool. This is one of my favorite Mud Kids tracks. So
yeah,
good,
me too.
Good choice. I represent from midnight to high noon. Redenbacher, smashing up your chakras and boxer, cater like vodka on the rocks. Stop you in your tracks, make your vocals match. We got international options, vocals catch up. Get out the mustard and no horseradish, add it with your crab. But got sister, all that stuff, caps and whip around your cabbage like a halo. Shake you for your pesos. You must be on the yayo. Around your KO, got your chicken side kicking like Kato. It's smart like NATO. For lots of fives like Plato, have a tendency to hate those haters right back, reverse it. And number four,
Ain't No Thing by Outkast. I love this song. The beat is amazing to me.
Ready from the get-go. Y'all hear my go, it's Andre. Can your punk come out to play? Say, stay in your little hole, then coward duck your head. You don't know who you be. But you better off. That is what I say. Best run the other way in case the physical breakdown. Y'all can break now.
Number five, the last song, Mandog.
This song is called Easy by Sun Lux. I was actually an intern at Joyful Noise Recordings where they put this album out, and yeah, just really like this album and this song.
And Sun Lux, Ryan Lott, the artist behind Sun Lux, is kind of an Indiana connection, right? You went to IU. I think you went to the Jacobs School of Music and kind of semi off and on lives in Indianapolis, right?
Easy. Easy. Pull out your heart to me now. Being alone. Easy. Easy.
And Mandog, I'm a big fan of your beats. They're very creative. You put a lot of creativity into your work. Give us a little thumbnail sketch of what you do musically.
I make music, and I like to draw from all types of influences and kind of put sounds out there that people haven't heard but still feels really right. That's kind of how I describe it.
And as I mentioned, you have a new album with the Indianapolis rapper Diop. It's titled Flow Flexin'. It's available online. And where can folks go to hear more of your music?
You can go to my Bandcamp. That's got most of my stuff on there. So it's bandcamp.com/themandog, no spaces.
Thank you, Mandel. Appreciate it.
Hear Kyle's A Cultural Manifesto on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio Wednesday nights at 8 or Saturday nights at 10. Thanks for listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble, and today's contributors included Melissa Davis and Jill Dittmeyer. Hear The Art of the Matter Saturday mornings at 7 or join us Thursday nights at 8. And remember, you can always listen to and share our podcast at WFYI.org. Next week, painter John Klinkos can't escape water and exactly what happens at a poetry carnival. And of course, we'll have that arts calendar we call What'll We Do? All of that and much more on The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. The Art of the Matter is executive producer Roxana Caldwell, producer Melissa Davis, contributor Jill Dittmeyer, and host Sharon Gamble. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.